Turning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts off with Why Violence Has Declined. Harvard professor Steven Pinker is interviewed by Neil Conan, host of Talk of the Nation on National Public Radio.
Steven Pinker is a Harvard professor of psychology whose books on language and visual cognition have received numerous awards. In his work, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, this experimental psychologist turns his attention to the topic of human violence and our perception of its prevalence in our time. In a thoughtful, often surprising conversation with NPR's Neil Conan, Pinker discusses trends and statistics that support his premise that despite the impression left by the 24-hour news cycle, we may be living in the most peaceful era in human history. Live from the Kentucky Author Forum in Louisville, Kentucky, this is Great Conversations, Steve Pinker and Neil Conan.
And I have to begin by asking, did you know when you asked your mother why you couldn't push the peas onto your fork with your knife that you'd asked a profound question?
I did not know it at the time, but that was one of many surprising discoveries that I made when I examined the history of violence, among them the theory that one of the reasons that violence declined between the Middle Ages and the present is that people restrained their impulses, showed more self-control, and among those manifestations was table manners, particularly knife taboos.
Knife taboos because... Yeah. clearly these are threatening things, and you explained to me the reason why knives that we get at our services have all rounded edges and can't cut a thing.
The phenomenon that this theory was meant to explain was why the homicide rate declined by about a factor of 50 between the, say, the year 1200 and the present. So a current Englishman has about 1/50th the chance of being murdered as his medieval ancestor. It goes against the stereotype of the carefree Middle Ages, people dancing around maypoles and all of that.
Three jolly coachmen.
Yeah, they were... The problem was that the slightest insult and someone would stab someone else over the dinner table. For one thing, they all carried knives in their belts. The way that you would eat was there'd be a big carcass on the table. You'd carve out a chunk with your knife, stab it with a tip, put it in your mouth, and that was the way that people ate. Well, for one thing, it makes it easy for disputes to escalate in that case. And even when they started to calm down, just the image of the kind of point of a knife aimed at a face was a little bit too touchy. And so a set of knife taboos, such as never point with a knife, never hand someone a knife, arose. And one of them was don't use a knife for any purpose other than cutting. And including pushing peas onto your fork, which indeed I was taught was bad manners. Now I know why.
A lot more efficient, but bad manners. In any case, it is the manners of the court that begin to filter down through medieval society that begin to affect first the upper classes who have to appear at court to ask the favors of the monarch, and then, of course, the middle classes, who are emerging at the same time, ape the manners of the upper classes, and thus on down the ladder.
Yes, these manners, this self-restraint, self-control, dignity, trickle down from the court. We have a word for it, courtly manners or courtesy. It's not a coincidence that that the word court is in courtesy. And it trickled down. We now think of violence as something that is done to a large extent by poor people in the not-so-nice parts of town. But it used to be the aristocrats who committed the lion's share of the violence. If you remember the opening scene of Romeo and Juliet, two aristocratic families basically have a kind of a gang fight in the streets and bodies are end up on the ground. But the aristocrats stopped a lot of their dueling, their conflicts to defend their honor, and from there it trickled down to the middle class.
You describe it as the transition from a society based on honor to one based on dignity.
That's right. We think of honor as an exalted value, but what honor means in most times and places is that to be a man, you've got to defend your reputation with violence. If someone offends you, threatens you, insults you, then you lose standing unless you are prepared to react violently. That's still true in many parts of the world. It's still more true in the American South than the American North, where there are stand-your-ground laws and a variety of manifestations of a culture of honor. But it's the decline of the culture of honor in Northern Europe, Western Europe, the northern United States, that was in part responsible for the decline of one-on-one violence. And that's just one form of violence that I discuss in the book.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll admit that there have been some problems in the White House, but there is one problem around here that is definitely going to get fixed. Here, buddy, here, boy. Come on, buddy. Here he is. Hey, how's my buddy? Oh, no, wait. Hey, stop. Get off there. That's federal evidence. Oh, down. Ladies and gentlemen, my buddy.
A great female I'll never get when that he-male takes me to the vet. 'Cause to be male, you need a full set. So never forget, you've got... gotta have parts. Getting neutered really smart. And don't apply to be a puppy intern. That's where the trouble starts. It won't be much fun. I'll feel testy when it's done. And doing this to any dog who's a mutt's totally nuts. No pun. They can't re-glue them or re-stick them. They'll be thrown out in a pan. Just last week I learned to lick them. Like they say, because I can. Places where I stick my nose will end up in the trash disposal. Oh, cruel, cruel fate. And I hear Hillary can't wait. When my puppy jewels are chopped on the block, she'll ask the doc to state.
Hey, doc, you got a group rate?
You introduce us in the process of this book to several thinkers who I must confess I had never heard of before. One of them, Norbert Elias. You just told me the pronunciation a minute ago. I'm not going to pretend I knew it beforehand. But a man who came up with an explanation as to why all of this happened, why that murder rate plummeted in Western Europe over those centuries.
Yes, so Norbert Elias, a German sociologist forced to flee Germany when the Nazis took over, a Jewish academic whose parents died in the concentration camps, and who had the very bad luck of publishing a book called The Civilizing Process in Germany in 1939.
Tough crowd.
Yeah, tough crowd. It kind of seemed like a bad joke. So he was forced to flee. He ended up in England. He was interned in a camp because he was German, and finally he was let out. He got some jobs.
It's called the double whammy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. From the he was still better off at that internment camp than what the alternative would have been. Yeah. But his theories were only rediscovered in the late 60s. He was still fortunately alive at the time, so that he could comment on them, and. He worked from old woodcuts and books of table manners and descriptions, narrative descriptions of what life was like on the ground. It was only later that historical criminologists started digging around in archives and calculating homicide rates, because the records in Europe go back literally 800 years. So they started to plot these homicide rates on a graph over time, 1200 to the present, and what do you know, the rate plummets. Like goes from close to 100 per 100,000 per year down to 1 per 100,000 per year. And so these quantitative data come out that vindicate his intuitive observation that the Middle Ages in Europe were a more violent place than the present. And so he was the only one who had a theory ready to explain it.
And two theories, in fact, two explanations that went on at the same time.
Yes, so there was a psychological component to his theory, namely the increase in self-control. We know that everyone has an ability to count to 10 before you explode, to hold your horses, to save for a rainy day, all the things that your mother tells you as you're growing up.
Along with not to put your
peas onto the fork. Don't eat until everyone else is seated and served. So all of those forms of self-control, we all have it, but we exercise it to various degrees. And his claim was that there was a increased emphasis on self-control over the centuries. Now that just begs the question of, well, why did everyone wake up one morning and decide to wait for everyone else to be served and not to respond to insults by stabbing your dinner companion? Why all the self-control? And the first domino in the chain that led to lower violence was the consolidation of kingdoms out of the feudal patchwork of the little principalities and baronies and duchies. They started to get consolidated into territories like France that ruled by a king, and the king started to impose a court system over the country. They not for any benevolent motives, but he would just as soon that if someone killed someone else, that they would, the penalty would be give a lot of money to the king. So it was a great source of revenue to have this justice over the within the borders. So the nationalization of criminal justice was one of the first dominoes that got the process going. The other one was an infrastructure of commerce. Money that could be recognized within the borders of the newly consolidated states, better roads, better carts, better clocks, enforceable contracts, all kinds of things that made it cheaper to buy things than to plunder them, and made more and more of the rest of the world valuable to you alive compared to dead. And so if the way to get ahead was not to kill the other knight's peasants and take over his land, but to sell him stuff that you have and buy stuff that he has, it removes the incentives for violence. And these two developments, I think he was quite ahead of his time, because I think that they were two of the major forces that you see throughout history as reducing violence.
And it brings to mind another of the thinkers, this one better known, about whom you write, and that is Hobbes, who we generally remember for a short, brutish, and nasty.
Yes. Yes, and Hobbes emphasized the necessity of having a, as he put it, a Leviathan. His idea was that if you surrender the prerogative of violence to one disinterested authority, in his case, most likely a king or absolute ruler, then, for one thing, you would have less incentive to attack your neighbor because the Leviathan would penalize you and kind of cancel out anything you hope to gain. But it would have secondary effects, namely, not only are you disincentivized from attacking your neighbor, but you know your neighbor is disincentivized from attacking you. And that makes everyone calm down, because you're not tempted to launch a preemptive strike to do it to him before he does it to you, because the king will do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to maintain a belligerent macho stance to deter your potential adversaries, because the king is tougher than you are. So you don't have to have this culture of honor where you respond to insults with violence to prove that you're really tough and firm and resolved enough to defend yourself. So that whole macho culture winds down. And also, you don't have each side figuring out who's at fault and who deserves to be punished. And this is, Hobbes anticipated one of the great findings of social psychology, which is that everyone thinks that he is pure as the driven snow, up there with the angels, and that the other guy's violence is unprovoked, raw aggression out of the blue, but you know, my violence is justified retaliation after the fact. Well, you can imagine if you have two sides both thinking that, then you get these blood feuds and Hatfield and McCoy situations, whereas if you have a disinterested third party who's reckoning and beating out justice, granted the government is not always totally disinterested, mm-hmm. but still better than each side serving as his own judge, jury, and executioner.
I was fascinated to see this come up in the formulation of court cases. In other words, a murder case not all that long ago was between individuals, and it could be settled, as we saw not too long ago in the case of the CIA contractor in Pakistan, with payment of blood money.
Yes, blood money, their guilt,
and
man wealth. Yeah.
As opposed to definition of murder as a crime against the state.
Yes, that's right. So when you turn on Law and Order and it's the state of New York versus such and such, or the people versus such and such, that actually does indicate a historical change, because it used to be more like a lawsuit. The family of the murder victim would demand blood money from the perpetrator or the family of the perpetrator if they've killed the perpetrator, and that's what would even the score. The brilliant idea that some king had was, hey, why should the money go from the family of the murder victim to the family of the perpetrator? And that was really the origin of the court system. Namely, the money goes to the king. But what it, as a secondary effect, you now have more or less disinterested third parties deciding justice. Ideally, you've got Justitia, the goddess of justice with the blindfold, the scales, and the sword, and she's the one making the decision instead of the aggrieved victim.
And that brings us to a series of questions that it seems to me involve the United States as both exemplar and outlier, because you notice this plummeting of murder rates in Western Europe. Well, it happens to some degree in the United States too, but only to some degree. The United States does not go down anywhere near as far as Western Europe, nowhere near as far as Canada.
Yes, so among Western democracies, the United States is deeply weird in that it is an exception to many trends that have swept over the rest of the West. The United States, as you mentioned, has a far higher homicide rate. It has come down over the last 20 years, but it used to be that the American murder rate was almost 10 times the rate in many Western European countries. And it's certainly much higher than England and even higher than Canada. The United States is the only Western country that still has capital punishment. The United States is far more willing to go to war than other Western countries like France and Germany, as we recall from 2003. In many Western European countries, corporal punishment in school has been eliminated, and indeed spanking by parents in many Western European countries has been illegalized, and it's considered a human rights violation. The United States, in many of these trends, the interesting thing is that the United States is actually moving in that direction with a bit of a lag. And within the United States, the northern and coastal states are ahead in this trend compared to the southern and southwestern states. And so, kicking and screaming, our country has been pulled in this direction of kind of Scandinavianization. So Rick Perry and Mitt Romney and so on have a point when they say that the liberal states are moving in the direction of Scandinavia. But it's kind of, in case after case, it's been an inevitable progression. Another example is slavery. It took our country a lot longer to abolish slavery than most of Europe. But eventually we did it. And with all of these trends, we're behind the curve, but they tend to happen.
And we're behind the trend, but you interestingly put an argument for this code of honor that exists in the United States as an explanation for, we speak just about a month before the great election of 2012, for an explanation of why there are so many deeply red states and so many deeply blue.
Yes, so there is a anthropologists refer to cultures of honor as ones that still have the ethic that a man must defend his reputation with a credible threat of violence. They often trace it to either people who originated in mountainous areas, so not just the mountainous south of the Hatfields and McCoys, but many Southerners trace their ancestry to the Scots-Irish from the hilly parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland. They also trade it to cultures where your wealth is easily stealable, such as livestock. And the world over, livestock herders tend to be tough and mean and macho because they need to, because their wealth has feet and it can be led away in an instant. And it's much easier to rustle someone's livestock than to steal land out from under a farmer. And so cultures of honor often spring up in peoples who live in mountainous areas, who have mobile wealth. And you also mentioned a third contributor to cultures of honor, namely contraband economies. This doesn't apply to the South anymore during Prohibition. But zones where people trade in drugs or diamonds or booze when it's illegal, they feel they've been cheated in a business deal, they can't file a lawsuit. They feel threatened, they can't dial 911. The only way to protect your interests if you're living beyond the reach of the law is with a credible threat of violence.
When the mailman says no mail today to someone who's old and gray, though she's waited for years, she smiles through her tears and just thank you with all she can say. Though the rest of the world may be gay, there's sadness in her heart today. And that that wandering one never knows what he's done. When the mailman says no mail today, it's just an old story, you've heard it before, of someone who's wandered from his mother's door. She waits for a letter as the mailman goes by, and her heart is breaking as she hears his reply. Never knows what he's done. When the mailman says no mail today.
And now for something completely different.